Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Born to Talk radio show. And my guest today is Lee Shai Lemus. He is the Master of Ceremonies with Sen Yun Performing Arts, and he's also a podcast host of this Sen Yun Voices. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's really a great pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to talking to you.
Me too, because, you know, I think conversations are so valuable. They're valuable to me. And what's valuable about them is I'm interested in what other people do. I've been doing this for a very long time. And I'm always so excited to explore what other people enjoy doing. And let's just start off by just getting to know you a little bit about yourself. So just tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I was born in Ohio. In Columbus. My parents were both Buckeyes, and we moved around a lot. My dad's actually from California, so we spent some time in the Bay Area, and then I ended up going to school at Pomona College, which is part of the Claremont schools there in Southern California. I did my bachelor's degree in Asian studies, in Chinese language and history. And then my wife and I moved to London. At that time, I was already married, and we moved to London and did our master's degree in London. I did mine at the London School of Economics in International Relations. And this brings us to around 2005, 2006. And at that point, Sen Yun Performing Arts was starting, and I tried out and got a gig with Sen Yun Performing Arts as an MC. I can backtrack a little bit how that came to be, but that's my brief introduction. I'm also a huge baseball fan and a father of two.
That's terrific. You know, it's so interesting that here you are in the States and you go to London to get to further your education. I think that's really, really exciting and very, very interesting. So yeah. You mentioned Sen Yun, and you've been the MC since the show's inception in 2006. My God, that's 18 years. That, what a wonderful experience this must be. I'd like you to tell us about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's gone by so fast. It's hard to believe. I mean, we did 18 tours already, 19, depending how you count that COVID year, which is a bit of a funky year there. So as I mentioned, I was studying Chinese history and really kind of current affairs in China. And that was my interest. And it was really, I was coming at it from an interest in not just the culture and history of China, but really human rights in China. That was kind of my main focus. And I was primarily interested in this because of my background as more of a spiritual seeker. And so to backtrack even further, I don't know how much you want to get into this, but as a baseball player, I was a pitcher. And I was very serious about trying to make it professionally. This was in the 1990s, before there was all the stuff that we have now as far as training. I mean, there was a lot already back then, but back then people weren't talking about mental performance as much as they are now. There were a couple of books out there, and it was just starting to come out, and they were talking about meditation and visualization and guided imagery and positive talk and all this stuff. And I really got into that. And the reason I did that was because at a higher level, everybody has pretty good athletic skills and the training is very consistent. And of course, you can apply yourself in different ways, but really the mental side of the game is something that a lot of people weren't tapping into. But if you talk to some of the top athletes, the Tiger Woods, the Michael Jordans, the Greg Maddoxes of their sports, they will say it's really at the higher level, it's all about the mental game. I think Yogi Berra said baseball is 90% mental, the other half is physical, right?
Right.
And so I got into this world of like the mind, basically, of how our mindset and how we look at things can affect our performance in sports. And of course, now we, all the sports teams, the top ones, even at the collegiate level, have mental performance coaches, and they work very thoroughly on these aspects. But back then it was fairly new. And so I would start meditating before a game, and I would enter more of a state of relaxation and concentration and focus, and had this inner calm when I was pitching, and a sort of, people talk about a flow state or being in the zone. And I was experiencing that quite regularly. And I said, wow, you know, if our spiritual side, our mental side can affect baseball and other sports, what about the rest of our life? What about our relationships? What about our longevity? What about what we're here, our purpose here on earth, peace, world, whatever it might be? What about these bigger picture questions? And that led me down this path of looking at some Eastern philosophy things. I started with yoga, I did Tai Chi, and eventually I learned about this meditation practice called Falun Gong, which was very popular in China in the 90s, and it got so popular that the Communist Party there banned it. And I didn't even know that it was banned at the time. I didn't really know that much about it. This is around 2000. It had just been banned in 1999.
May I interrupt just for a moment? What was the name of that? What was it called again?
So that's called Falun Gong. It's also called Falun Dafa. That's Falungong. And I
Got
think
it.
people in the States have maybe heard of it on the news here and there, or maybe seen a parade, or maybe seen some people meditating in a park. And I think often people do associate it with the human rights issue in China because it's really one of the bigger human rights atrocities of the 21st century. It's the biggest group that's persecuted for their faith, just in terms of numbers in the world and world history even. The estimates from the Chinese government were that there were 70 to 100 million people practicing Falun Gong in the late 90s in China. It became very popular. It was free. People were feeling better doing it physically, mentally. It was very simple, five exercises, principles of truth, compassion, and forbearance. And people would just go into the park and meditating in the park, and they would read a book about it and the teachings, and they would go to work. And some of them were government officials, some of them were farmers. It didn't really matter. And at some point in the late 90s, the Communist Party looked up and said, you know, this is more people doing this than we have members of the Chinese Communist Party. And the head of the CCP at the time decided to ban it. And there were a lot of people against it.
Wow.
A lot of top people in the Chinese government knew that this was not a threat, that this was just a peaceful meditation practice. A lot of them had family members who were practicing. But Jiang Zemin, the Chinese Communist Party chairman at the time, decided to ban it, created an office later known as the 610 office, which is like a Gestapo. It's above the law. It controls the courts, controls the police, and their only purpose is to round up and arrest these people who were not political in any way. They were just meditators, people who, like me, were looking for the bigger answers to the bigger questions and some peace in life. And they became enemies of the state just like that overnight. And there was this big propaganda blitz, loudspeakers on top of vans circling around the cities 24/7. All the news was just about this. The airwaves were just inundated with this stuff. And then people were starting to get arrested from their homes, arrested from the parks. And then, of course, as they're arrested, then their family members go to the government and say, "Hey, what'd you do with our family members?" They have these offices in China called the Petitions Office or Office of Appeals, and that's where you're supposed to go if you have an issue. So people would go there. They'd write a letter saying, "You know, my mom was just meditating, and you came to our house and took her, and I haven't seen her in 2 months. Where is she?" And they would say, "Well, do you practice Falun Gong too?" And they said, "Yeah, okay, come with me." And then they would get jailed,
Oh my
and
goodness.
this went on and on. Yeah, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people within the first few months. I know many of these people, survivors of this. I've interviewed many of them back when I was doing more of the human rights work. And there are people in my company, on Shenyun Performing Arts now, who experienced this themselves, people who lost family to torture. There was a dancer, for example, in our group who, when she was an infant, her father was killed and his body was left in a ditch just because he was a meditator of Falun Gong. And this is somebody I know. And I have several examples like this, including people who have family jailed in China still. So this was something that it was a huge human rights issue at the time, and it still is today because it's been 25, 26 years of this now, and it hasn't stopped. It goes on to even more atrocities, which we can talk about later if we want to get into some of these darker things like organ harvesting. But it's a huge, huge issue, and it's not reported widely in the West. But in China, it's a big deal, and a lot of people experience it firsthand. If you have 100 million people who are affected directly, and these people have family, you're talking about almost half the country is directly affected by this,
My goodness.
Taking people out of the workforce and out of their families. Anyway, so I was looking into this and I was studying this and writing whether this was genocide or not. And that's what took me to London also to look at these things. And right around this time, around 2004, 2005, a friend of mine, a Chinese friend of mine, approaches me and says, "Listen, we're going to do a performance about Chinese culture," because you know the Chinese embassy and the consulate, they have their own performances, but we don't really like them. They don't represent us. They're just very red. They're all about how great things are under the PRC flag and how grateful we are to the Communist Party, and it doesn't have the traditional stories. It doesn't have the vibe that we want. So we put together our own performance, and it's coming to LA. I think we're at Cal State LA at the time. This is 2005 for the Dragon Boat Festival, which is in May. And they said, "Can you emcee it?" And my reaction, to be honest with you, was, "What are you talking about? You know as well as I do that people are being tortured and killed left and right in China. This is not a time for some song and dance production. No, find somebody else. I'm not interested. I'm writing about genocide. You do your song and dance." And she said, "No, it's gonna be, you'll see, it'll be great, it'll be fun." I'm like, "It's gonna be fun, I'm sure. But is it important?" And she said, "Come and find out." And she was just very persistent, and she was a good friend. And I said, "Okay, fine, I'll do it." At some point, it just became easier to accept it rather than put up with the badgering. And I did it, and we just did two shows. And I already had a few years of Mandarin Chinese under my belt, so I cracked a few jokes in Chinese, and people loved it, and it was fun. And I thought that was the end of that. But then when I was in London the next year, the same people who had organized that organized another production in New York. And this was already going to be the big time. This was Radio City Music Hall, 7,000 people in the audience, three shows. And it was going to be traditional Chinese culture, but also a lot of other elements. They had, I think, like the Empire Brass Quintet. They had some top ballet for the Washington School of Ballet perform. They had all these different things. It was just a Chinese New Year gala, they called it. And they somehow, I guess somebody there got a video of my performance in LA, and unbeknownst to me, looked at it, and they called me and said, "Would you come and see this?" I said, "Well, okay, sure." And then I came, and then now I started kind of to see the point of all of it, because I could see how art has power to move people. And then this was early 2006. By late 2006, Shen Yun was already starting to form. So the same people that had done these productions said, "You know what? Instead of just pulling together some people here and there and doing these random performances, let's do this for real. Let's create a company. Let's register a nonprofit organization. Let's base it here in New York. We'll bring the top artists that we know from all over the world to do this and see who else is interested. And let's have some dancers that are trained in classical Chinese dance. Let's not do ballet or anything else. Just do real traditional Chinese culture. And let's tell these stories." And they had a tryout, and I came up, and there were a bunch of different people trying out, and I got the gig. And so I didn't know at the time that it was going to be 18 years or however many it's going to end up being. I thought, maybe a tour a few months, and I'll go back to London, maybe do my PhD or something like that. That was kind of my plan. But then, we did a tour, and as we started, the tour got longer and longer. We ended up going from December to May that year. We went all over the US, all over Canada. We went to a couple cities in Europe and then all over Asia. We went to Taiwan and South Korea and Japan and Australia, New Zealand, some of these places I'd been to, like Taiwan, others I hadn't been to ever before. And we did about 100 shows, and it was amazing to see the reaction from the audience and how much of an impact this had. And the stories are ones about traditional Chinese culture and the virtues that they present, but really they're universal. Right, these ideas that these stories bring out of courage, of loyalty, of compassion and faith, and that there's a bigger picture. And at the same time, they're very Chinese in how they're being told, but they touch something very core, I think, about the human experience for people wherever we go. So you're in Paris one day and in Japan another day, and it still resonates with people, even though their cultural background is so different. And then as part of the show, we got to tell a little bit about the persecution in China. So because the company Shen Yun was founded by people who practice Falun Gong like myself, and who this was very a story that's very close to their heart, so they said, "Listen, as part of telling the story of 5,000 years of Chinese civilization, let's show people what's happening in China today also." And it's not the whole performance, but it's a couple of pieces. The way the performance is structured, and that's stayed the same every year from that first year until today, and will be the same in the future, as far as I know, is it's not one narrative. There is this overarching theme of traditional Chinese culture, but it's 20 different vignettes, about 20, each between the shortest maybe 3 minutes, maybe up to 7 minutes. And each one of these pieces tells a different story. Begins often with a legend about the origins of Chinese civilization, way up in the heavens, coming down to earth, and these deities and divine beings bringing a culture and for the benefit of humankind and enriching the civilization, and it comes down to the palace. And so you have that kind of legend, and you have different dances that are thematic. We have, for example, a water sleeves dance, which is really, really elegant. You see this often in our pictures online. We have ethnic and folk dances, and you have different legends like the Monkey King, different heroes from Chinese history. We had the real story of Mulan one year. So we have a bunch of pieces like that, and maybe one or two of them will be about what's happening in China today. And then there's a live orchestra, and there's all kinds of other things which I'm happy to talk about. But that's basically how I got involved in what Shen Yun is and what we do.
And you are the MC, so you're the guy on the stage. And it sounds like what you've said is that the production changes every year. Is that true?
Yeah, so every year we have an all-new show. That's one of our kind of one of our the things that we're famous for. And because there's 5,000 years of culture and legend and stories, you can pull out any moment from any piece of literature, from any dynasty, any heroic general or warrior, or even a poem sometimes, and make a beautiful dance out of it. I couldn't do it. The choreographers can do that, and it's amazing. And so yeah, we have an all new production. I think people who see the show every year, and we have people like that. We were just in Pittsburgh towards the end of this last tour, and I was in the audience meeting a few audience members. I think we got a proclamation from a council member there. So I was out there, and the woman came up to said, "I've seen you every year you've been here in Pittsburgh, maybe 7 years or so." And she said, "Not only that, I'm coming to see the show again tomorrow afternoon." So we have people like that who see it every year. But I think for the most, it's people who don't have that tradition of seeing the same show over and over again, not realizing it's an all new show. And so I think people will recognize some structures that are similar, but all the stories are different. All the choreography is different. The music's different. The costumes are different. The animated backdrops are different. So it's all new scores, all new songs. We have Arhu soloists. They play a new piece. So it's completely different every year, and that's a lot of work. So the way that it's built is we tour for about 4+ months, 4 to 5 months. We come back in May. Everybody gets a break. We do a little debriefing, and then everybody gets a break for a few weeks, and then. Surprisingly, what people like to do after traveling for 5 months is travel.
Oh, that's funny, isn't it?
Yeah. So
Wow.
we go all over the world. I was in Florida just now, and I had actually been to Florida on tour. So it doesn't make any sense if you think about it. That's what we do. And then we start really ramping up about this time of year. This is the time that the choreographers and the composers are working with some of the dancers to prepare the pieces for next year. At this point, here we are in June. Late June, I guess. I have no idea what we have coming up this upcoming tour in 6 months. I'll be on stage again at a theater near you, and I don't know what's going to be. But the choreographers do, and they'll work through it the next few months. By the time we get to the late summer, early fall, then we start doing rehearsals, and then we eventually keep refining it until we get ready to hit the road, and then we go out the door. And the other thing that's kind of special about Shen Yun, is that we have at this point, so the first year. We had just the one group that toured around the world. But there was so much demand and so much interest, and as well as a lot of artists coming out of China or coming from young people who were interested in dance coming from all over the world saying, "I want to study this, I want to be a professional dancer," that we formed a second group the next year. So the next year, we had one group that went to Europe, that was my group, and then one group that went to Asia. The third year, we had three groups, and then one did Europe, one did North America, one did Asia. And then at this point now, we have eight groups that tour the world at the same time. So when you see Shen Yun, for example, if you're in LA, we had Shen Yun in LA now, a bunch of different cities, but that wasn't my group. When they were in LA, I was in Boston and then in Florida and other places like that. So but everybody does the same show, but you have eight people who are MCs like me, and you have eight women who are MCs as well, and you have eight conductors and eight different monkey kings and so forth.
What's a monkey king?
So Monkey King is the main character in the classic novel Journey to the West. Journey to the West was written during the Ming Dynasty a few hundred years ago, and it actually had been passed down through the oral traditions for many centuries before that. And it's a story about a Buddhist monk during the Tang Dynasty, so the 7th century monk. An actual monk existed like this, who did this, but this is based on that story, who travels on foot from China to the West, to what is now known as India, it wasn't called India at the time, goes on foot to India in search of sacred Buddhist scriptures. So, and on his path from China to India, he encounters all these different trials and tribulations. In Chinese, all the numbers have symbolism, so it's 81 different ones. And he has some bodyguards because it's very dangerous. And this is where you get into the magic and the playfulness of all of this. the word had gotten out in the community of demons and monsters and goblins that if they can just get one bite of the monk's flesh, they would gain immortality. And so along the path, there are constantly monsters trying to eat him. And so he needs bodyguards. And the first bodyguard he gets is the Monkey King. Monkey King has his own origin story. He was once a deity in the heavens. He actually was born out of a rock. There's a lot to it, but he was born out of a rock that collected the essence of heaven and earth, became a stone monkey and then a monkey, and then eventually learned some Taoism, gained some powers, ends up in the heavens. But he's a monkey, so he's causing trouble. And then eventually, to appease him, they say, "Listen, you be in charge of watching these magical peaches of immortality. You be in charge of watching this orchard, and then just hang out there. And that's so important, you do that." And so, all the deities are having their party, and he thinks he's important, and he realizes he's not even invited to the party. So he creates a lot of chaos, and then goes back to Earth, and then he basically picks a fight with the heavens. And so all the deities, because in Chinese, the pantheon of Chinese deities is very complex, all these different levels. And of course, I'm generalizing here. There's Buddhist tradition, Taoist traditions, Confucian traditions, all these different ones. But in this legend, you have kind of, they all come together. There's the Buddhist ones and the Taoist ones are all hanging out. And so he basically gets into a situation where he's in a fight with the heavens, and eventually he ends up being tricked, and basically is punished to be placed under a mountain for 500 years, and his job is to wait there. And the Bodhisattva, the goddess of mercy, comes along under the guidance of the Buddha, who tells her, "Okay, arrange for him to protect this Buddhist monk." And so she comes to him. She gives him a choice. She said, "Listen, you can keep being stuck here under this mountain, or you can protect this monk, make sure he's safe on his quest for sacred scriptures, which is really important for the spread of Buddhism in history. And then, you can be free and you can return to the heavens." So he becomes the first disciple. And the interesting thing here is the monk is he's mortal. He has all the pitfalls, and he's gullible. He's naive. He's very kind, but he just gets always duped into different things. A typical scenario would be a goblin transforms into a beautiful woman who then she tries to seduce him but fails. But then she, maybe needs his help with something, so he then goes along. And then the goblin tries to eat him, and then a monkey comes to the rescue. The monkey's got penetrating vision; he can see through any illusions. He can fly, can do all this stuff, but he's limited in his abilities because he has to travel by foot with this monk. Because he could have just done a flip and gotten to India in one day and gotten the scriptures. So he's the first one. Then they're joined by an even crazier character called Pigsy, who's a half man, half pig. He got into his own trouble because he was a bit of a skirt chaser. And so he got into trouble with that in the heavens. He got banished and punished too, but he gets a chance at redemption. And there's another one. Anyway, so the whole legend of Journey to the West, in a way, is a metaphor for a spiritual path, for somebody's spiritual process of going through tribulations, realizing different things, overcoming desires, overcoming fear, sticking to the right path, and eventually succeeding and getting redemption. And that's really what the story is about. We're not going to tell the whole story in a Xing Yun production.
Okay.
Typically, we'll have just one chapter of that.
Got
Like, for
it.
example,
Got
how
it.
Pigsy became part of the journey. That's
Okay.
Monkey King for you.
My goodness. Wow. That's a lot for me to take in.
That was the abridged version. If you want to read the whole thing, there's a long book on it.
My gosh. So I think you've mentioned that this is a collection of about 5,000 years of divinely spiritual culture bringing it to the world stage. How does that manifest itself?
So, really, when you talk about 5,000 years of Chinese civilization, what we're talking about here, and you see this on our banners, on our billboards, on our commercials, is China before communism. That's our tagline. And so we're talking about the civilization that had been there continuously until the Chinese Communist Party came to power in the middle of last century, 1949. And the reason that Chen Yun is showing this in a way is because this civilization has mostly been lost at this point. In China, there's traces of it left. You can still see some of the architecture. You can still see some of the some other remnants of it in religious traditions, but the essence of it, the spiritual essence of it, is mostly gone. And that was a deliberate campaign by the Communist Party when it came to power to wipe out what had been there before. So when it came to power, the first thing it set out to do was bring in this Soviet ideology, this Marxist and Leninist and Stalinist ideology to China. And to make room for that, they had to remove everything that had been there before. These stories, like I mentioned now, and the values that they represented. And I think the main thing, if you ask me to kind of summarize what it was that they wanted to replace, was this idea of a connection between our life right here in the present, in this material world, and the bigger spiritual realm. The idea that there's karma. The idea that what goes around comes around. The idea that there's some form of something that happens to our soul. And there are various explanations for that in Chinese civilization. They're all very different in some ways, but they all have to do with reincarnation or being accountable to your ancestors or our Judeo-Christian heaven and hell format. It all has to do with the fact that if you do something now, you have to be accountable to it. And you can't just live for your material benefit and not care what you do to other people. And that's what Chinese civilization really had at its core for thousands of years. Respect for the higher powers, a humility, and a value-based culture. And that's why when different dynasties came and went over these 5,000 years, you could replace a dynasty with a different emperor. And they could even move the capital to another city, and they would have their own different clothing style and their own different ways of ruling that they would enact. But the culture, the civilization itself continued on. It was carried through the language. It was carried through the stories. It was primarily carried through these virtues that held the civilization together. You can even have somebody from outside, from Mongolia, like Genghis Khan, come in and create his own dynasty, the Yuan dynasty in the 12th century, and still continues Chinese civilization, even under foreign occupancy. They may not be happy about it, but the traditions and the virtues continue and, in fact, influence Mongolian culture tremendously when they were there. And the same with the Manchurian culture of the Qing dynasty, and there's other examples. And so these were the things that held it together. And so when the Communist Party came in, they said, well, we got to remove all that. Otherwise, how do we get people to do what we want them to do? Right. How do we bring in this Orwellian society where you have Big Brother watching over you, where you have the Ministry of Truth and all these different things that are straight out of 1984? How do you bring that if people believe that there are gods 3 feet above their head, as the Chinese saying goes, that are watching everything that they do? How can we do that if they believe that after they die, they're going to have to talk to their parents and grandparents and say, well, what did you do with your life? How did you handle these situations? So they started these campaigns, and the most prominent and well-known was the Cultural Revolution under Mao Zedong from 1966 to 1976. And during this period, they set out to destroy the artifacts, that is the physical representations of Chinese culture, burning temples, burning artwork and books, marrying monks and nuns, getting them out of temples, destroying ancient architecture, smashing Confucius statues. So they did that so that those physical objects would not be there. And then they made students publicly criticize their parents in big squares in these struggle sessions, or beat up their teachers to death sometimes. And then they would send the whole generation of people, take them out of school, send them to the countryside to learn from the farmers. But the main purpose was so they don't get an education, cut off the educated class entirely from the traditions. And of course, killed many, many people along the way. To this point, as far as we know, from 1949 to today, the Communist Party in China has killed 60 to 80 million people. That's more than World War I and II combined. Mao Zedong alone did more than Hitler and Pol Pot and Stalin. So that's the kind of stuff that people in China have lived through. And this is not that long ago, the 60s and 70s, you know, historically speaking, when this happened. And now you have several generations of Chinese people who lived under this system. And the parents don't tell their kids what happened during the Cultural Revolution. They don't tell them about the Great Famine during the Great Leap Forward, where 40 million people starved. They don't tell their kids about that. People in China today, young people, don't even know what happened in 1989 with the Tiananmen Square massacre. They certainly don't know, a lot of them, what happens to Falun Gong practitioners or to Uyghurs today. And so you have a civilization now, a culture that is, information is kept from them, but they're also cut off from their traditions. And that's how you get this kind of TikTok culture. And you have skyscrapers and all these other things and technology, but you really have, to use a term that my Chinese friends call, moral bankruptcy, because you're cut off from everything that had been there, the heritage that had been there for thousands of years that kept the civilization together. So Shen Yun, what Shen Yun is trying to do is actually a huge undertaking. It is taking this culture and bringing it back from the brink of extinction and showing it on stage and saying, this is what Chinese civilization was actually about. It's about these ideas and these values, and it's beautiful. And it's not to say that everything was perfect. Yeah, there was war and famine and stuff like that before too, sure. But there was a lot of beauty there and a lot of values that really inspired the rest of the world. We know scientifically many of the inventions, China is well ahead of the game. You know, gunpowder and the compass and paper and pasta, of course, all these different things long before they came to the West. And at some point, they started losing that, and they really lost it when the Communist Party came to be. And so for my Chinese friends who are part of Shenyun, what they like to say is, you know, for example, some of them grew up in California, and they say in Arcadia or in Alhambra, and they in Chinese communities, and they say, you know, they were. I'm just paraphrasing what they said. So this is their words, not mine. They
Sure.
were embarrassed of being Chinese. They were
Okay.
embarrassed growing up feeling Chinese, and because they thought, oh, Chinese being meant cheap products and, you know, like political persecution. They were embarrassed to say that they were. But then they joined Chinyin. They learned a lot more about their culture by becoming a dancer, by training for several years, and then eventually joining the company and getting to tour and really showcase the culture to the world. And now they're proud of it, and that's their dream, is to share it, and not just around the world, but actually bring it back to the people in China. And that's an interesting thing too, because we get messages from people in China. We haven't talked about this yet. We can't perform in China. That's the
Oh.
one place in the world we can't perform. And we get messages from people in China saying, when are you coming to China? We're on your side. We can't wait for you to bring back the civilization. We got an email the other day for somebody with their cell phone number. They said, come back to China. Here's my number. Call us when you get here. We can't wait to come see you perform. So it's a big undertaking. And the thing is, the Chinese Communist Party really doesn't like that we're doing this, because here we are showing this culture that they worked so hard to destroy for 75 years. And we're showing that. We're showing what's happening in China today. And people realize, oh, that's what Chinese culture was like or could be like in the future. And, you know, in this era where there's all this, you know, tension about, well, can we criticize the Chinese Communist Party without criticizing the Chinese people? Are you racist if you don't agree with what they're doing? You know, people make a very clear distinction when they see the show between Chinese civilization, Chinese people, Chinese culture on the one hand, and the regime that is ruling the country on the other hand. And that's also something that the Chinese Communist Party is very afraid of. So if you want to talk about it, there's a lot I can get into there in terms
Well,
of what they're trying to do.
I have a few questions I'd like to ask you. So it sounds like there's a lot of historical stories being told via dancing and I presume music, correct?
Yes, so the
Okay.
main art form is classical Chinese dance.
Okay, so it's
And
classical Chinese dance. And so while
yeah.
they're dancing, I would presume you're not speaking.
Right, okay, so here's the format, yeah? So I'll come on stage with a Chinese lady, and we will say a few sentences in English and Chinese, very brief, not as long as my rambling just now, really, really quick, like 1 minute, and we're out of there. And then so, for example, the whole Journey to the West rant I gave you now, I do that in six sentences. The
Okay.
classic novel, Journey to the West, tells of a Buddhist monk on a quest for sacred scriptures. Along the way, he's protected. I just go through it real quick. Like, I don't speak this fast, but that's what I do.
All
And
right.
then we get off, and then that just gives people an introduction to the piece, just enough so they can understand what's going on without having to have read the 500-page book or taken a course on this. So, and we don't give the plot away. That's really important. Not to give the plot away. So we just introduce it. People can watch it. They don't have to read the program. They don't have to prepare. And then the dance comes on. It's 5, 6 minutes long. The dance finishes. The curtain comes down. And oh, there are the MCs again. The light comes on. We have our microphone. And we introduce the next piece. And it's maybe an ethnic dance of the e-ethnic group. And what is an ethnic group? And oh, there's an ethnic group within the Chinese ethnic group. So we introduce that idea. And now we travel to Southwest China, where the people of the e have preserved their culture for thousands of years. Ladies and gentlemen, the ethnic dance of the E. We get off stage. That's what we
Okay,
do. And that goes on about 20 times a show.
I want you to take a deep breath, all right?
Thank
Exactly.
you.
I don't think I've ever had a guest that has. I want to just jump in with all these questions. So let me just. So, because I'm curious, I've never been to this before. So you've given us a lot of background here. So I'm thinking about this as an audience now. And so what I'm curious to know, you just said that there's multiple starts and stops, correct? Is that what you're saying? Okay. And is there traditional Chinese instruments that are being played?
That is a great question. I'd love to talk about that briefly.
Okay.
So we have a live orchestra that accompanies the show. It's in the orchestra pit, and it's a combination of classical Western and traditional Chinese instruments, and is, to my knowledge, the first orchestra to have combined these two instruments successfully as permanent members. So this is not just something you do for one show. The whole tour is like that. So you have your Western string instruments, your double bass, your cello, your viola and violin. You have the flute, right, the woodwinds, clarinet, oboe, and bassoon, and then you have your brass, right, trumpet, French horn, and trombone, and you have percussion. And then you have the Chinese instruments. You have a range of percussion instruments that are Chinese, including the gong, which is Chinese. And then you have the stringed instrument that's plucked, called the pipa, which is held vertically and it's plucked. And then there's the two-string erhu, which is sometimes known as a Chinese violin, but it's very, very different and very Chinese when you hear it. And sometimes you see it on the subway, and it's not played to the level that we would want typically on the subway. But in the orchestra, it sounds amazing. And so what Qianyu has been able to do is allow these instruments that are so different to blend together harmoniously. And that's been very, very difficult for other people to accomplish. But our composers, our artistic director, everybody, the whole team, they were able to put it together. And it's a lot of work. And so, yeah, they accompany the whole show.
Wow, that must be beautiful. I would imagine people would like to go home and say, how do I buy this recording of this beautiful music? I mean, I'm
We
not
have
sure.
a symphony orchestra actually that combines, because as I mentioned, we have eight companies that tour at the same time, so we have eight orchestras. And actually, they kind of like in Transformers, where the little guys combine to make a bigger guy. They join together and make a symphony orchestra that performs at Carnegie Hall and a few other
Oh,
theaters
that's
around the country. And
fabulous.
they have DVDs as well.
That's
The
cool.
show doesn't have a DVD.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about the traditional dances. Is there something very traditional about what they do?
Oh yeah, so classical Chinese dance is the main art form, and it's different from ballet. It's I would say it's like the Chinese parallel of ballet. So with ballet, we go back a few centuries. People typically trace it back to Louis XIV and the French court. And it's at this point, it's still changing in many ways with modern elements, but it's very systematized. It's got its own training and its own forms and requirements. Classical Chinese dance is the same way in a Chinese context, and it goes back thousands of years. So Chinese dance, and the classical form of it, really evolved in parallel to Chinese martial arts. Back in the day, in the palace, in front of the emperor, after a long day, maybe after a battle, maybe just after training, they would have these big banquets, and the emperor would sit up on his throne outside often, and they'd have drinks, and they'd have these big parties, and the generals who just came back from the training ground or the battlefield would perform. They would take out their swords and do these spear and sword dances, and they do all these flips and amazing moves of martial arts. But here, martial arts was being used as dance. And that became a key element of classical Chinese dance. The idea that the same movement that you might use to dodge a spear in battle becomes a backflip in classical Chinese dance, or a spin kick. And so they eventually evolved to look quite different. They're In classical Chinese dance, they're rounder. It's not about getting from one point to the next as quickly as possible. It's about how do you do it as beautifully and as gracefully as possible. It's much lighter. But you can recognize some of the traces of the same elements. And then it also incorporated some elements of street performance and other elements of just the folklore of traditional Chinese culture. And it became this systematized form of classical Chinese dance. And this form is alive in China. You can find a couple of schools, even more, that who teach it. But the issue is they often there's a couple issues there. One is that they often mix in other art forms with it. So I think when they perform for the West from China, they often thought that people in the West would not understand this and say they would mix it with ballet or they would mix it with modern dance. And at the to you to the point that you really don't know what you're looking at anymore because it's a mishmash of different things. That's one element. The other element is that it doesn't have the spiritual essence behind it of the traditional stories. They're not allowed to perform that. So one of our main choreographers, for example, came out of China, several of them. But I remember one of them said he was at one of the top schools there, was trained there, was in one of the elite institutions for classical Chinese dance. That the training is great, but I can't perform freely there. I don't have the freedom of artistic expression there. And that's what I came to Shenyun for. And so we have people like that. We actually have, you know, sadly, people who wanted to join us, but were caught before they could leave and were barred from joining us. So this art form, when people see it, it's really breathtaking because it's so athletic. You have these high flying flips and tumbling techniques. It's very, very flexible. It's very expressive and very subtle hand gestures. And you can express just any story, any emotion, any legend, depict any character through this art form. And so in a way, my job is a little bit redundant because you can really convey everything through dance and music. But because we have the stories, the MCs do come out and explain the background. And we also talk about how classical Chinese dance has this history that actually influenced other art forms. So the one you might recognize the most is if you watch Olympic gymnastics or acrobatics. I know you're a sports fan, right? If you watch some of this stuff, you'll see these flips, right? And even in cheerleading at football games, you might be surprised. Some of these moves, many of them, actually originate from classical Chinese dance.
Interesting. Well, yeah. You know what I'm curious about? You were sparking a lot of curiosity that I'd like to just interrupt you if you don't mind.
Sure.
And that is, are there as many men as there are women? How does if I was to look at this ensemble on the stage, what would I see?
That's a good question. So you would see some dances where it's both men and women together, but you would see some dances where it's only men or only women.
Okay.
There might be one where it's mostly men and one woman, but typically the stories will have more performers on stage at the same time and typically will include both female and male roles. But then there's also dances that are very, very masculine and dances that are very feminine. And so it's both.
And so between each of these dances, that's where you come in and you tell the story. And then now I'm watching the story.
That's right.
Got
it. And not all of them are stories. Some of them are thematic. We had a dance about the plum blossom. That was just about this beautiful flower and its symbol of courage.
Right. Yeah. Do they wear special costumes?
Yeah, so that's another element that people comment on a lot. And we actually have, especially in New York City and in Hollywood, designers in Italy too, I should say, in Paris. Okay, a few places who come to see the show just look at the costumes. And actually, you can sometimes then see traces of our costumes in their designs the following years. It's kind of interesting. So the costumes are, listen, they're made for stage, so they're very light and durable because we do about 100 shows per group every year and they travel a lot, the costumes do, but they're designed to look as authentic as possible. And if you actually look at some of the artwork from the Tang Dynasty, 1400 years ago or earlier, Han Dynasty 2000, and even before that, you can actually see what the attire looked like. And the costumes then follow that very closely. For example, water sleeves. This is one of the favorite ones. My dad always loved this piece. It's a dance where they have these long flowing sleeves that are maybe 8, 9, 10 feet tall or long. And they as they dance, they kind of toss them out and they billow like rippling water. And then they pull them in, they catch them right away and it's gone. And then they might do twirls. I don't want to take away a surprise for anybody, but it's really, really beautiful.
That's nice.
And there's statues from the Tang Dynasty of court dancers with those sleeves. So this is something that you were asking me before, how do you bring back this 5,000 years of civilization? So here we have a court dance that was performed for the emperor 1,500 years ago, and now you're seeing it on stage in Los Angeles.
Something. Wow. I think you said that the season's going to be ending next month, right? So when will the 19th season begin?
We just ended a month ago. So we tour from December to May. Right around Christmas is when we start.
Oh, it's already ended. I'm sorry. Okay.
That, the 2025 season. I know it's funny to say that the 2025 season is over when we're in June.
That's okay.
Yeah. But the 25 season is over. And then we're starting preparation for the 2026 season. And usually our first shows are around December, around Christmas.
Uh-huh.
And then we go until the first or second week of May.
Wonderful. I will definitely make sure that your website is on my blog when we're all through, because when would people be able to see the schedule for the next 2026?
Yeah. usually around the fall, late August or September is
Of
when they
this year.
start. Yeah, I've already seen a few of the cities are already up there, and we actually have on the website a place where you can sign up to get notified for your
Oh,
city.
wonderful. Wonderful. That's good to know. Do you anticipate that this show might be different than the previous shows?
Oh yeah. So one of the things that we're going to have to do is in a month or two when we start talking to choreographers, understand the stories, and then we start writing the script for what we're going to say on stage. And we really try to approach it from the perspective of, okay, if I'm in the audience and I've never heard of the story and I don't know what's going on, what would I need to know to understand this dance? What's the minimum I need to know to
Right.
understand this dance and what it's trying to convey? And then we put that together. We try to introduce some humor and some curiosity. We have a couple of jokes, and then we get out of the way.
Is that on the program, any of that information when people are coming to see it?
Yes. So if you have arrived at the theater early enough, and we do recommend people get there at least half an hour early.
I bet, yes.
They tend to be pretty packed, so you want to find your seat. Yeah, we have programs, and the programs go through the whole production in terms of who the artists are and then what pieces are going to be, and then there's a description for each piece that goes into a bit more detail than what we say on stage, and we try to not make it repetitive as well, so you
Sure.
can get both. And if you just read that, you're in good shape.
Well,
It's really not that hard to follow. I mean, my kids, are 6 and 10, and they come to see the show, they have no problem following it.
that's really that's, and I'm just visualizing this. I'm sure it is so beautiful to witness and to hear, and the grace of just the movements. But behind that is an incredible story, and I think that that's the part, frankly, that I didn't understand until you and I were having this conversation.
Yeah, and I think that is really what drives these performers to do what they do. Because let's face it, it's not easy to be a professional dancer.
Right.
You have to train hard. You may not feel great every day. Something's going to be sore, or you may have something going on in your personal life, but you have to put all that aside when you go on stage. But these people, you see the show, and one of the comments we get from the audience members all the time is, they're just so impressed by how genuine the performers are, and their smiles, the joy that they project from the
You feel
stage,
it, right?
that it's
Feel
real.
it.
It's not an act.
Right.
And I think that comes from this greater sense of purpose, be it having experienced persecution themselves or family languishing in China today,
Sure.
or just wanting to share this beauty of this heritage, and that really is for the whole world to enjoy and to learn from and to borrow. That's I think what drives them to do this day after day, night after night.
That makes sense to me. Within the few moments that we do have left, this isn't all you do. So you also host a podcast, right? The Shenyun Voices, where you interview many of the cast members. How long have you been doing that?
Not as long as you've been doing your show, that's for sure.
Well, hey.
I've only done one season so far. We did that last year. And it was a bit of a response. It wasn't a direct response, but it was a little bit of a response to a situation that we found ourselves in, which is, as we are performing around the world and bringing back this culture and telling people what's happening in China, the Chinese Communist Party in Beijing is watching this and is saying, well, this is a problem for us. We have to try to stop it. And so they've been doing a lot actually to try to interfere with us. And I have a whole website. You ask me what else I do. I have a whole website that's been documenting all the stuff that they're trying to do, which is now has a term. It's called transnational repression. It didn't have this term when I started documenting this in 2006-7.
Wow.
But basically, they're trying to pressure theaters to cancel our shows here in the U.S. They're writing to elected officials telling them not to go see the show. This often backfires because in America, if you tell a congressman don't go see a show, they'll probably go check it out just to find out what the deal is.
Right.
And then they try to pressure media, and they have all these other campaigns on social media, paying YouTubers to put out negative content about us, hacking our website, slashing the tires on our buses. And
Gosh.
it just goes on. I got 135 of these cases documented.
Man.
And so part of that has also been trying to get kind of the Chinese Communist Party's narratives against us, their propaganda, which they're very skilled at doing, into mainstream media. And so we found ourselves in a situation where people were asking us all kinds of questions that really didn't compute. It's like, why, like, for example, is it true that you, you know, train really hard? You know, well, yeah, we're dancers.
Yeah,
we train hard.
Right?
You no, show me a professional.
Simple.
Yeah. So I said, let's create this podcast and let's let the artists talk. Let's hear what they're not the MC, not the spokesperson, not just the artists themselves. Let's grab some people who speak good English and ask them some questions. And that became the podcast. And so I interviewed some of our principal dancers. I interviewed some younger dancers who are up and coming. I interviewed a mom of a dancer. I interviewed a doctor to kind of find out what kind of medical care they get. And, you know, he talked about that and then the treatment that they get for when they do get injured and how well they're treated. Just a range of people. And that was the first season. I enjoyed it a lot because I got to know these people better. And some of them have really interesting stories.
You don't by any chance speak Chinese, do you?
I do.
You do speak Chinese. Oh, my God. What else do you
But
do?
The podcast is in English.
Well, okay, fine. But I'm just saying how terrific that you can speak and understand Chinese. I mean, that just adds to your credibility and what it is that you do, what you do. And
well, I fell in love with the language right away as soon as I started learning it. I came into Pomona College having just started to be interested in Chinese culture and in Falun Gong meditation and in human rights in China. So let me learn Chinese and see so I can communicate with Chinese people better and really understand the culture at a deeper level. And it was an 8 a.m. class, you know, and Pomona's not a party school, but, you know, these are college students in California. And so everybody was coming in all groggy and I was there sitting straight, you know, ready to go, notebook out, you know, pencil sharpened. Let's go. It's 8 a.m. Chinese class. I loved it. And it's such a beautiful language. And that's what's fascinating about a culture that's lasted so many thousands of years consecutively is that I can pick up a book or a poem from the 6th century and understand it. Every once in a while, not to lie to you, I do need to look it up in a dictionary. But for the most part, I can figure it out. It's easier than reading Shakespeare for me. It's a lot closer in some ways. And it's beautiful. I love the simplicity of ancient Chinese language. I love communicating with Chinese people. And of course, you know, I speak Mandarin, but there are all these other dialects. There's Cantonese and Shanghainese and all these other ones. And so if I were actually to go roaming around China, I probably would get lost very quickly as well. But it is a lot of fun.
Have you been there?
I have been there, but I'm now blacklisted from going back.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, we'll just leave it at that.
That's another episode.
Certainly. But you know, I'm a podcaster. You're a podcaster. Do you intend to continue to do that because you don't have enough to do?
Yes, for precisely that reason.
I
do enjoy talking to people. I think it's a question of how many episodes we'll be able to do,
sure.
As opposed to yes or no. There's a lot of questions. I want to dive more into this topic of China before communism with some of our guests, because some of our choreographers have deep, deep knowledge about this. And they can really talk about what it was like and what the principles were and what architecture was like and what the food was like and really get into these fun aspects beyond just talking about, like, you know, some of the not so fun things that are happening today.
Sure.
So I'm looking forward to doing that as well. And there's a lot of stuff to geek out on when it comes to the specifics of classical Chinese dance and music. Like, how do you get the Chinese arhu to play with the string section? And what do you work on when you use sectionals? And how does a conductor help you? A lot of fun stuff like that, too.
Right. I was thinking the same thing. I was thinking I could see where you'd want to talk to the choreographers, but I would also think you'd want to be speaking to the musicians as well.
Yeah, the musicians are fun. And I had a couple, for example, on the podcast last year from Venezuela. And it was as a couple. She's a bassoonist and he's a violin player. And just talking to them and getting their take. What is it like to be a married couple? What is it like to be not Chinese in an orchestra where most people are ethnic Chinese, even if they're from around the world, but they're ethnic Chinese? And, you know, those kinds of, it was a lot of fun. A very, very fun couple. And the musicians have, you know, I read this study where musicians, people who train in classical music for at least 10 years when they're kids, have stronger empathy. They're able to pick up nuances of other people's behavior, tonality, and things like that because they're so attuned to that from their years of musical training. I think that's really fascinating to explore.
It is. I could see you writing a book.
That's Thank you. I thought of it as well. I'm a little bit hesitant to jump in because I know how much work it's going to be, but I do have an outline.
That leads me to my last question for you, because I'm listening to this conversation that we're having and I'm thinking, holy cow, how does this guy do all this? So, how do you manage to balance? I suspect that you're probably a yogi. I suspect that you do meditation. So how do you balance your work life and your personal life?
Well, I mean, if I had an answer to that and wrote a book about that, I'd do really well.
Well, you
that
got
is,
5 minutes. Then knock yourself out.
it's an evolving process. I do have my systems in terms of keeping track of everything, my various project lists, and I write everything down.
Yep, me
I'm
too.
known for always writing stuff down so I don't forget because I don't trust my brain to remember it.
Yep.
I have my two daughters who keep me sane. I come home. When I'm there at home, I make sure I'm very present with them and engage with them and not on my phone or other stuff that's so easy to do, but really trying to be there with them. It's a small window of time every day. It's a small window of time in life. So I try to treasure that. I do meditate. I should probably meditate more, but I do meditate when I can, and then that brings peace, even if not in the moment necessarily. I think sometimes, we can go into meditation thinking, how come I'm not calming down? But afterwards, just that process of connecting and calming down brings a certain tranquility to the rest of the day,
I'm
even if not in the
agreeing.
moment.
Well,
Yeah.
not only that, but you do a lot of traveling. So I'm just trying to imagine your lifestyle. You mentioned you've got a couple of kids and a wife. It's like, whoa, thank God that there's the kind of technology that we have today where you can do a Zoom call with your kids and talk to them.
Because I mean, I'm old enough to remember what it was like. You call your grandmother in California a couple times a year and you have to schedule it long in advance, and the phone rings, you don't know who it is, and you can never see them.
Right.
Whereas now, I remember when my first daughter was born, about 2 months into tour, there was one day where we did not FaceTime, and I was so upset at my wife. Like, I missed a day in my daughter's life. What is going on? Do you know how much this means to me? And later, I'm like, that's ridiculous. You missed one day. But I was just so used to connecting with her, having that
Sure.
FaceTime or whatever call every single day. And we're big on reading in my family. I actually brought books to the hospital when my daughter was born and sat and read books that first night. And she's an avid reader now. I read books to them on the phone.
Nice.
Sometimes we'll buy the same book. They'll have a copy. I'll have a copy, or we'll use a Kindle. And we keep in touch. If the tour, sometimes during the tour, the schedule is such that we get to come home for a little bit. Like this past year, I came home quite a few times. That was great. Other
Nice.
times, we're out the door. We don't come back until the end of tour. In those situations, they will fly out
Oh,
almost
that's
without fail
nice.
a couple times. They come out for a few days. Like they came out to Taiwan. They came out to San Antonio, wherever. We'll pick a spot and they'll come out for a few days, hang out. They'll see the show. They love the show. They know a lot of people. So, it's definitely not easy on the people back home, but
Sure.
that's for my kids, that's what they know. It's always been like that. And my wife's a trooper, and credit to her that she's able to keep it together when I'm away. And I try to make up for it by doing the dishes a bit more when I'm home.
You're cute. Well, this has been really interesting, and people can listen to this podcast wherever they live. And the fact that you tour everywhere, I know that I'm not going to want to miss this when you come to LA, because this just sounds fascinating. And I think I'm going to love the music as much as I'm going to love the dancing, because what you just described, and then the stories that accompany what the value is of the dance and the music. I just think this is fabulous. And you're going to have your 19th year of doing this. I just, what a lifestyle you live. And I just want to thank you so much, Lishai, for just spending this hour with me and sharing what it is that's so important to you. This has just been delightful.
It's been really nice. I'm glad we got to jump into some of these topics, and thank you for your patience, allowing me to really geek out on some of these and go into detail. It's been really nice.
Well, you know what? I was born to talk, honey. It sounds like you were as well. So maybe that's what we have in common. But I have thoroughly enjoyed this, and I think that people that are listening to this are going to be very interested in checking this out. I will make sure that your website is prominent where people can see that. Also your podcast if people want to listen. And just follow along and wait to see when your next tour is coming through, because I would think that everyone that's listening to this is going to want to go and see it. And I know that that's how I feel about this. So just thank you once again for spending this hour with me. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Okay, you have a good rest of your day, my friend.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.